So we're in Zechariah 11, and it really, a lot of the commentators say it's a really difficult chapter to really understand. So before we get started, I want to go to Matthew 21, and starting in verse 33. Jesus says, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servant to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. Then he sent other servants to them, more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They'll respect my son, he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance. So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? He will bring those wretches and to a wretched end, they replied, and he will rent the vineyard to other tenants who will give him his share of the crop at harvest time. And Jesus said to them, have you ever read in the scriptures, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. Anyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. And they looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. So we have this interaction between Jesus and the religious leaders. And effectively, he's saying to them, you don't have the right to reject me because this is my Father's land. This is my Father's house. And the prophets have come and you've mistreated them, you've killed some, and now he's sent his son and you're going to treat him poorly, throw him out of the vineyard and kill him, just as Jesus was killed outside Jerusalem. And as Jesus is telling the parable, the religious leaders are going, oh, that's terrible. We know what's going to happen. The Lord's going to come back and he's going to deal with those people. And Jesus says, yes, you are the people. Now, one of two responses could happen there. They could repent and say, we never realized, you know, forgive us. And but their response was, well, now we're really upset with you, so we want to kill you, not realizing that they were actually responding in the same way. Now, in Zechariah 10, remember, we're talking about God establishing the New Jerusalem, the city without walls, the city where all the nations would come and live in the peace of God. It's an image of the church. It's an image of life with God. It's an image of heaven. And in Zechariah 10 and verse 10, it says, I will bring them back from Egypt and gather them from Assyria. I will bring them to Gilead and Lebanon, and there will not be enough room for them. They will pass through the sea of trouble. The surging sea will be subdued, and all the depths of the Nile will dry up. Assyria's pride will be brought down and Egypt's scepter will pass away. I will strengthen them in the Lord and his name, and in his name they will live securely, declares the Lord. So God promises to restore Israel, but there's this curious phrase that they will pass through the sea of trouble on their way back to the city. Now, this is where we need to understand a bit of history. And as I said, I hope it doesn't get too sort of heady, intellectual or whatever, but if we don't understand this bit of history, then it makes it difficult to understand what the Lord says through Zechariah in this chapter. So it was in the year AD 66. So this is sort of towards the end of when the scriptures are being written. The Romans are in Jerusalem. Jesus was crucified about 36 years before. The Jews began to rebel against their Roman masters. The Roman procurator, Gessius Florus, he was having a bit of trouble. His tax revenues weren't high enough. And so he started to actually seize silver and stuff from the temple so that he could prop up his income and, you know, didn't get into trouble with Caesar, I guess. And so an uproar began to grow against him. And he sent some troops into Jerusalem and he massacred about 3,500 people. Now, so that made the people in Jerusalem pretty upset. And so they began to rebel against the Romans. And while that was happening, the Emperor Nero then sent an army under the leadership of the general Vespasian to restore order. And so Vespasian took his army and began to encircle the city, Jerusalem. And by the year 68 AD, resistance in the northern part of the province had been eradicated, and the Romans then turned their full attention to Jerusalem. But in that same year, Nero committed suicide, and the Roman Empire was thrown into disarray. Vespasian, who was the general leading the attack against Jerusalem, was called back to Rome and he became the emperor. Now, when he got back there, he realised that the job with Jerusalem wasn't finished, so he sent his son Titus, Vespasian's son Titus, to lead the attack against Jerusalem. And in the year AD 70, the Roman legions surrounded the city, Jerusalem, and began to slowly squeeze the life out of it. So they had it under siege, and by 70 AD, the attackers had broken through the outer walls of Jerusalem and began systematically demolishing the city. And the assault culminated in the burning and destruction of the temple, which was the Second Temple. Now, in the process, the Romans slaughtered thousands of Jews, and of those who were spared from death, thousands more were enslaved and sent to toil in the mines of Egypt, and others were dispersed to arenas throughout the empire to be butchered for the amusement of the public. And the temple's sacred relics were taken to Rome, where they were displayed in a celebration of the victory. And the rebellion of the Jews sort of spluttered along for another 3 years and then finally came to a culmination in the stronghold of Masada in AD 73, where another massacre of the Jews, and that pretty much finished up the Jewish sort of rebellion. Now, the only first-hand sort of account by a Jewish historian by the name of Josephus Flavius. He was actually a leader in the Jewish community, but when Vespasian sort of came in, Josephus managed to work his way and win the favour of Vespasian, and so he sort of took Vespasian's name, Flavius, and became a bit of a historian and so recorded things. And how are we going? We're doing all right with this? These are the words, translated words, of Josephus talking about when the Romans sacked Jerusalem. He says, the rebels shortly after the attack, attacked the Romans again, and a clash followed between the guards of the sanctuary and the troops who were putting out the fire inside the inner court. The latter routed the Jews and followed in hot pursuit right up to the temple itself. Then one of the soldiers, without awaiting any orders and with no dread of so momentous a deed, but urged on by some supernatural force, snatched a blazing piece of wood and, climbing on another soldier's back, hurled the flaming brand through a low golden window that gave access on the north side to the rooms that surrounded the sanctuary. As the flames shot up, the Jews let out a shout of dismay that matched the tragedy. They flocked to the rescue with no thought of sparing their lives or husbanding their strength. For the sacred structure that they had constantly guarded with such devotion... I've lost my place now, it's jumped away. Sorry. I'll get there. Was vanishing before their eyes. No exhortation or threat could now restrain the impetuosity of the legions, for passion was in supreme command. Crowded together around the entrances, many were trampled down by their companions. Others, stumbling on the smouldering and smoke-filled ruins of the porticos, died as miserably as the defeated. And as they drew closer to the temple, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's orders, but urged the men in front to throw in more firebrands. The rebels were powerless to help. Carnage and flight spread throughout, and most of the slain were peaceful citizens, weak and unarmed, and they were butchered where they were caught. The heap of corpses mounted higher and higher about the altar. A stream of blood flowed down the temple steps, and the bodies of those slain at the top slipped to the bottom. When Caesar failed to restrain the fury of his frenzied soldiers, and the fire could not be checked, he entered the building with his generals and looked at the holy place of the sanctuary and all its furnishings, which exceeded by far the accounts current in the foreign lands and fully justified their splendid repute in our own. As the flames had not yet penetrated the inner sanctum but were consuming the chambers that surrounded the sanctuary, Titus assumed correctly that there was still time to save the structure, and he ran out and by personal appeals he endeavoured to persuade his men to put out the fire, instructing Liberalis, a centurion of his bodyguard and of lancers, to club any of the men who disobeyed his orders. But their respect for Caesar and their fear of the centurion's staff who was trying to check them were overpowered by their rage, their detestation of the Jews, and an utterly uncontrollable lust for battle. Most of them were spurred on, moreover, by the expectation of loot, convinced that the interior was full of money and dazzled by observing that everything around them was made of gold. But they were forestalled by one of those who had entered into the building and who, when Caesar dashed out to restrain the troops, pushed a firebrand in the darkness into the hinges of the gate. And then, when the flames suddenly shot up from the interior, Caesar and his generals withdrew, and no one was left to prevent those outside from kindling the blaze. Thus, in defiance of Caesar's wishes, the temple was set on fire. While the temple was ablaze, the attackers plundered it, and countless people who were caught by them were slaughtered. There was no pity for age, and no regard was accorded rank, and children and old men, laymen and priests alike, were butchered. Every class was pursued and crushed in the grip of war, whether they cried out for mercy or offered resistance. Through the roar of the flames, streaming far and wide, the groans of the falling victims were heard. Such was the height of the hill and the magnitude of the blazing pile that the entire city seemed to be ablaze, and the noise, nothing more deafening and frightening, could be imagined. There were the war cries of the Roman legions as they swept onwards en masse, the yells of rebels encircled by fire and sword, the panic of people who cut off above, fled into the arms of the enemy, jumped away again. And their shrieks as they met their fate. The cries in the hill blended with those of the multitude in the city below, and now many people who were exhausted and tongue-tied as a result of hunger, when they beheld the temple on fire, found strength once more to lament and wail. Perea and the surrounding hills added their echoes of the deafening din, but more horrifying than the din were the sufferings. The Temple Mount, everywhere enveloped in flames, seemed to be boiling over from its base, yet the blood seemed more abundant than the flames, and the numbers of the slain greater than those of the slayers. And the soldiers climbed over heaps of bodies as they chased the fugitives. It's a pretty horrific description. It was a complete massacre and destruction of the city and of the temple. So the message of Zechariah is that Jesus has come to establish the new covenant, that he's come to establish a new city. And it's a covenant not just with Israel, but with all nations. But it seems that the new covenant couldn't be fully established until the old was done away with. And the destruction of Jerusalem by Vespasian in AD 70 signified the end of the old, because they could no longer worship at the temple. Now, if we go to Luke 21 and verse 5, it says, some of his disciples, Jesus' disciples, were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus answered, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Teacher, they asked, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign that they are about to take place? And he replied, watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name, claiming, I am he, and the time is near. Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and of uprisings, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away. Then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes, famines and pestilence in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will seize you and persecute you. They will hand you over to synagogues and put you in prison. And you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on the account of my name. And so you will bear testimony to me. But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves, for I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You will be betrayed even by parents, brothers and sisters, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. Everyone will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. Stand firm and you will win life. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be for those days, for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. On the earth, nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. He told them this parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they sprout leaves, you can see for yourselves and know that summer is near. Even so, when you see these things happening, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. Be careful, or your hearts will be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and anxieties of life. And that day will close on you suddenly like a trap, for it will come on all those who live on the face of the whole earth. Be always on the watch, and pray that you may be able to escape all that is about to happen, and that you may be able to stand before the Son of Man. So we have here Jesus talking about the destruction of the temple, and his disciples say, when are these things going to happen? And he says, well, there's some things that have to happen first. So this is at least 40 years before the destruction of the temple. And Jesus goes on to explain the things that are going to happen, that the city is going to be surrounded. And he says, if you have opportunity, get out of the city because the destruction is going to be severe. He says, in the meantime, you're going to be persecuted. You're going to be, you know, killed for my sake, which is what we read throughout the scriptures, which, you know, are being written. And then it says, and there's going to be signs in the heavens, which talks about sort of changes in government and so on. And then he talks about the Son of Man coming on the clouds. And you'll recall that previously in the prophets, it talks about God coming on the clouds when he comes in judgment, when he brings destruction on a nation. And it would seem that Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple as the things that are going to happen before that generation passes away. Now, I know that that's probably a bit of a contentious issue, actually, and we've talked before about disputable matters. So feel free to disagree with me, and that's fine. But when we consider Zechariah 11, the elements there seem to only really make sense to me when we sort of approach things from this angle. But as I said, feel, you know, it's one of those issues that you can disagree on, and that's fine. I'm not going to be upset, and I hope you're not upset with me if you do disagree with me too. All right, so let's get into Zechariah, because that's the background that I'm sort of, if you like, the lens that we want to sort of be looking through. So in Zechariah 11:1, it says, "Open your doors so that fire may devour your cedars. Wail, you juniper, for the cedar has fallen. The stately trees are ruined. Wail, oaks of Bashan. The dense forest has been cut down. Listen to the wail of the shepherds. Their rich pastures are destroyed. Listen to the roar of the lions. The lush thicket of the Jordan is ruined." And this call for the doors to open. Now, Lebanon was an area of Israel that was very densely wooded with cedars. And because in the rebuilding of the temple, they used the cedars of Lebanon to rebuild the temple, the doors of the temple and, you know, even the temple itself would be referred to as Lebanon. And so the call for the doors to open so that fire may devour the cedars seems to be a call for the destruction of the temple. And then it says, "Wail, you juniper, for the cedar has fallen. The stately trees are ruined." And the implication is that if the cedars are destroyed, which are big, strong trees, and while it also talks of the temple, it speaks of the religious leaders or the leaders in the community, that then if that destruction is happening, then those who are not of that same social position should be worried, because if they can't stop the destruction, what can you do to stop the destruction? And the oaks of Bashan wail because that dense forest has been cut down. So it's a cry for the people of Jerusalem to mourn because there's destruction coming. Now, in the Talmud, which is a... there are two... Let me just go back a step here. In the Jewish tradition, there's Torah, which is the law of God written down. But then there was also an oral tradition that went with the Torah, which was called the Talmud. And it's kind of like a commentary on what the scriptures have to, what the Torah had to say, as well as some recordings and opinions on different things. Now, there were two sort of main Talmud sources. There was the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud, and they were kind of kept separately, but they both documented some events that happened between AD 30 and AD 70. So in this sort of period between the crucifixion of Jesus and the destruction of the temple. How are we going? Am I just being too intellectual today? But I don't know how else to approach it. So, and here's what happened. it's recorded that from 30 AD to 70 AD, every night the priest would go and lock up the doors of the temple, keep it safe and all that sort of thing. And up to that time, when they'd come back in the morning, the doors would still be locked, as you would expect. But for a period of 40 years, from AD 30 to AD 70, it's recorded in the Talmud that when the priest would lock up the temple and they'd come back in the morning, the doors would be wide open. And it's recorded that Rabbi Yohanan, having been the rabbi that would come and discover this in the mornings, he said, "O temple, why do you frighten us? We know that you will end up destroyed, for it has been said, 'Open your doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour your cedars.'" And so during this period from the crucifixion of Jesus up until the destruction of the temple, there's this sign of the doors of the temple being open and God's warning the people to flee the city because destruction's coming. And even the rabbis who wouldn't accept Jesus recognize that as a warning of destruction. There were three other things that happened in that 40-year period. One of them was that when the menorah, which was the lamp in the temple, there were a few of them, but the western menorah was meant to be there like an eternal flame. It wasn't meant to go out, showing that God's presence was there. But for 40 years between AD 30 and AD 70, the priests would go in and find that the menorah had gone out. And so they would relight the menorah, and the next day they'd come back and it was out again. And they tried everything they could to keep it alight, but it would go out every night. The other thing that happened during that 40 years is that with the on the day of the Day of Atonement, that's the word. So the Day of Atonement would come every year, and what would happen in the Day of Atonement is that two goats would be brought in, and the priest would cast lots then, and one of the goats would be sacrificed for the sin of the people, and the other goat would be led out into the wilderness as the scapegoat and released into the wild. Now, the way that they would work out which goat to sacrifice and which goat to send out into the wild, which goat would become the scapegoat, they would cast lots. There was a box and two stones in the box, and the priest would reach into the box and grab a stone in each hand and bring them out, and the one that had the black stone was the goat that was going to be sacrificed on that side, and the one on the side with the white stone was the one that would be released into become the scapegoat. And so it was considered a good omen if the scapegoat, if the lot for the scapegoat fell on the right hand. And for 40 years, every year, the lot for the scapegoat fell on the left hand, which, you know, statistically, I think it's about 1 in 1.1 trillion or something to see that happen. There was also a miracle that would happen every year in that the... so that they remembered which was the scapegoat, which was the goat to be sacrificed, they would tie a crimson cord around the goats. And so the one that was to be sacrificed, they'd tie the cord around its neck so that they knew that that's where to cut, I guess. The scapegoat, they would tie the cord around its horns because it was going to be led out into the wilderness. And up until AD 30, there was a miracle that happened every year, apparently. The crimson cord on the scapegoat would actually turn white, just miraculously. Then from AD 30 to AD 70, the cord stayed red, as if to say there's no forgiveness anymore through the temple. Now, I saw that and I thought, that's just a bit spooky, put it that way. Maybe it's just sort of something that Christians are just sort of going with, but it was amazing. I've sort of read a number of texts by Jews who were trying to say This is not a proof that God's left the temple. It was a proof that he was unhappy with the unjust system and that they were to continue, you know, that it's not really proof that Jesus is the Messiah. It's proof of other things. But they didn't deny the fact that those things happened. So, we've got this warning that's going out to the people of Jerusalem for 40 years, saying, get out of the city because destruction is coming. Because Zechariah had said, open your doors, Lebanon, so that fire may devour your cedars, which is what happened when Vespasian came and sacked the city. In Luke 21 and verse 23, it says, how dreadful it will be for those be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There will be great distress in the land and wrath against the people. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in the sun, moon and stars on earth. Nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. People will faint from terror, apprehensive of what is coming on the world, for the heavenly bodies will be shaken. And so there is this warning to get out of the city because destruction's coming. So now Zechariah turns his attention to the leaders of the Israelite community, and there's no way I'm going to get through this chapter today. But we'll get as far as we can. So verse 4 says, this is what the Lord my God says, shepherd the flock marked for slaughter. Now that statement alone is a pretty significant one, because he's saying that this city is going to be destroyed, the city Jerusalem. Verse 5, their buyers slaughter them and go unpunished. Those who sell them say, praise the Lord, I'm rich. Their own shepherds do not spare them. For I will long to have pity on the people of the land, declares the Lord. I will give everyone into the hands of their neighbours and their king. And they will devastate the land, and I will not rescue anyone from their hands. Zechariah 10 and verse 2 says, the idols speak deceitfully, the diviners and see visions that lie. They tell dreams that are false. They give comfort in vain. Therefore the people wander like sheep oppressed for lack of a shepherd. And my anger burns against the shepherds. I will punish the leaders, for the Lord Almighty will care for his flock, the people of Judah, and make them like a proud horse in battle. See, God's heart was that he would come in and shepherd the people. He's the good shepherd. Jesus said, I am the good shepherd. It's a pretty significant political statement when he says that, because he's saying, I'm the rightful leader of the people. But they wouldn't have it. They rejected him as the good shepherd. And as a result of their rejection of him, the flock was given over to wicked shepherds, idolatrous shepherds, and the consequence of that is that, you know, when you don't have a shepherd who cares for the sheep, the sheep are just marked for slaughter. They're going to perish because the wicked shepherds only care for themselves. But noting that the violent shepherds rejoice because they think they're going to profit from the destruction that's going to come to the sheep. Verse 7, so I shepherded the flock, marked for slaughter, particularly the oppressed of the flock. Then I took two staffs and called one favour and the other union, and I shepherded the flock. In 1 month I got rid of three shepherds. The flock detested me, and I grew weary of them and said, I will not be your shepherd. Let the dying die and the perishing perish. Let those who are left eat one another's flesh. See, as the good shepherd, God had shepherded the flock with the staff of, it says favour there, but that's a word that can be translated in a few ways. It can also mean beauty, can also mean grace. And the other staff was union or bands. That is, God shepherded the people in grace and beauty and with union. He kept the people in the Israelite community together and in union with him and in union with one another. And we also see that Jesus, as he said, came for the lost sheep of Israel, that he's come particularly to look after the oppressed of the flock, the ones that are being treated poorly by the wicked shepherds. And we also see a reference to three shepherds, which is, I guess, a bit of an obscure one, and if you read the commentators, there's a lot of disagreement about who they are, but it says that he removed them in 1 month. Neville was talking this morning about when Jesus silenced the Pharisees over the issue of taxes to Caesar. And we see that particularly in Matthew 22, there's a segment where Jesus silences three groups of people who were shepherds over the people of Jerusalem. And that is the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Herodians. They were sort of the three shepherds that were put out in a month, effectively. But having rejected the true shepherd, the shepherd then has no option but to reject the flock. And in Luke 13:34, we see Jesus saying, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who sent you, how often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing." So it says in verse 10, "Then I took my staff called favour and broke it, revoking the covenant I've made with all the nations. It was revoked on that day. And so the oppressed of the flock who were watching knew it was the word of the Lord." So having rejected the true shepherd, the good shepherd, he breaks his covenant by breaking his staff that he shepherded them with. The staff of favour or of beauty, which is the covenant that they lived under. So he breaks his covenant with the nations. Now God's covenant with the nations is actually bigger than his covenant with Israel. It's interesting. He didn't say he breaks his covenant with Israel. He says he breaks his covenant with the nations. And to find a place where God actually covenants with the nations, we have to actually go back to Noah, where he promises that he'll never destroy the whole earth again with a flood. And we talked about this recently. Because the rain and the water was the instrument by which he destroyed the whole earth, he then, promising Noah that he would never destroy the whole earth in the same way, took his bow and set it in the sky to say, "This tool of destruction I'm going to hang up, I'm not going to use that anymore." And he covenants with the people of the earth that he's going to restrain his wrath for a time. And having revoked this covenant with the nations now, God says, "I'm going to pour out my wrath on the earth once more." And if you like, he takes up another bow and he uses the bow to pierce the side of Jesus. And his wrath, God's wrath, is poured out on his son. And we see destruction occurring, but the focus is on his son. And we then see the crucified Christ hung in the sky as the sign of the new covenant with all the nations. So Jesus effectively is the staff, and his breaking signifies the end of the old covenant and the beginning of the new. And it says there that the oppressed of the flock, that is the lost sheep of Israel, were watching and knew it was the word of the Lord. And we see that when Jesus was crucified in Mark 15:37, it says, "With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" Perhaps showing that he was a lost sheep of Israel, just like the Samaritan woman. that he recognized this is the word of the Lord being accomplished here. How are we going? Do you need me to stop now, or can I go a little further? Verse 12 says, I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which you valued me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter at the house of the Lord. Then I broke my second staff called Union, breaking the family bond between Judah and Israel. You know, a worker is worthy of his hire. And the good shepherd says, well, if the flock doesn't want me, I'm going to leave my flock. But what is it worth to you? What's my hire for the time that I've spent with you? And they pay him 30 pieces of silver. Of course, Matthew 27, verse 3, when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. I've sinned, he said, for I have betrayed innocent blood. What's that to us? They replied, that's your responsibility. So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. And then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priest picked up the coins and said, it is against the law to put this into the treasury since it is blood money. So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the field of blood to this day. Then what was spoken of by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. So Jeremiah as well as Zechariah refer to these 30 pieces of silver. Now, 30 pieces of silver was the price to be paid according to the law if you had a bull and the bull gored someone to death, and that person that was gored to death was a slave or a servant, then if you were the owner of the bull, you had to pay the owner of the slave 30 pieces of silver as recompense for the fact that they'd lost a slave. And so here we have Judas being paid the 30 pieces of silver because Jesus, the servant of God, was about to be gored to death by a bull, which, you know, you would say the Roman Empire, or you could say that it was Israel. but of course, that would be unjust because Judas wasn't the master of Jesus. So Judas threw the money back into the temple so that it would go to the master of the servant. And Zechariah says that the Lord said, throw it to the potter in the house of God. The potter at the house of the Lord. Now, who's the potter at the house of the Lord? They were priests there, not potters. But, of course, God says in Isaiah, I'm the potter. You're the clay. You know, don't say to me, why have you made me? And so on. But the inference is that God is the one to whom the payment was due because Jesus is his son, even though they treat him as a slave. And so the payment for those 30, you know, for the goring of the bull, if you like, came back to God. But that's only half the transaction, because the other thing that needed to happen, if a bull had gored a servant, the 30 pieces of silver was paid, and the bull then had to be stoned to death because it had taken a human life. And so in making the payment, the leaders or the shepherds of Israel were then declaring their guilt for the goring of Jesus by the Romans. And as a consequence, because God is a just God, the city of Jerusalem was effectively stoned to death because of the guilt that they admitted by paying the 30 pieces of silver. I might be drawing a long bow here, but it seems to me that it's an incredible economy that the purchase of the potter's field was accomplished through such a small amount. And God is the potter, we are the clay. So the potter's field is a place where the potter would go to dig out his clay. And mankind was formed out of the clay of the earth. And effectively what it's saying is Jesus sacrificed, has purchased mankind for himself. But in doing so, the staff of union with Israel was broken because Israel had rejected the true shepherd. Then the Lord said to me, take again the equipment of a foolish shepherd, for I'm going to raise up a shepherd over the land who will not care for the lost or seek the young or heal the injured or feed the healthy, but will eat the meat of the choice sheep, tearing off their hooves. So with the true shepherd gone, Israel is now for the first time completely exposed to the foolish shepherd, if you like. He's the antithesis of the good shepherd of Jesus. And so that would make him an anti-Christ, because he's the opposite of Christ, who is the good shepherd, who won't care for the sheep at all, but will steal and kill and destroy. And what we see in Matthew 27 and verse 15 is that when Jesus was being crucified, it says that now it is the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. And at that time they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Barabbas. So when the crowd who had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you? Barabbas or Jesus, who was called Messiah? For he knew it was out of self-interest that they had handed Jesus over to him. Verse 20 says, but the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. Well, what shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Messiah? Pilate asked, and they answered, crucify him. Verse 24, when Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I'm innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. And the people answered, his blood is on us and on our children. And then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed over to be crucified. So the people rejected the good shepherd and took in his place a wicked shepherd, Barabbas, who was a leader of a rebellion. He was a murderer and so on. And, you know, while it doesn't say specifically that this is the foolish shepherd that was sort of put in place, that the story kind of implies that they had rejected the true son of God, the true shepherd, for a rebel who would only abuse them, because he was a foolish shepherd, and a foolish shepherd just lets the sheep wander wherever they want and do what they want. Barabbas never went on to lead the Israelite community, as far as I know. Anyway, verse 17. Woe to the worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. May his arm be completely withered and his right eye totally blinded. So there's sort of the loss of strength and the loss of vision for Jerusalem, because the shepherd is becomes impotent. Matthew 24 and verse 23 says that at that time, speaking of the destruction of the temple, or leading up to the destruction of the temple, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, there he is, out in the wilderness, do not go out. Here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. So just as the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, having been set free from Egypt and waiting to inherit the promise, so it seems that the Israelites spent 40 years wandering from the time they had been set free by the crucifixion of Christ until they came into, I guess there was this period of grace until that generation passed away before the fullness of the kingdom was perhaps established. There's, you know, but an incredible passage, Zechariah 11, speaking of this time of transition between the old and the new. The promise still stands that he would establish a city without walls where all the nations of the earth would come. But you can't establish a city where there's already a city. And so it seems that there was a grace period of 40 years for people to either flee the city, come to know the Lord, as for the people of Jerusalem during that time. But ultimately his judgment had to come in to fulfill all that occurred around his crucifixion. So there we go.